from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had our eye off this particular ball for a while now. The new Iraq. We left. The reason we left is because Iraq's president or prime minister, which is it? Who cares? We're gone. Maliki wouldn't accede to our demand for blanket immunity. You know, the kind the Corps of Engineers has for all American troops left in Iraq. So we said, okay, no immunity. Good luck with the thing. So here's the new Iraq as it stands now. More than 6,000 people have been killed in violence across Iraq this year, according to the group Iraq Body Count. This reverses a decline in sectarian bloodshed, which reached its previous peak way back in 2006 and 7, when we were there. It's not clear who was behind the most recently reported killings of some journalists who worked for the Iraqi television channel Al-Sharqiya News, which is often critical of the government and is popular among the country's Sunni minority. Why would you target them? They were shot in the chest and head. Iraq is considered, the new Iraq, that is, the one we left behind, proudly, to be considered one of the most dangerous countries for journalists in the world. 261 journalists have been killed and 46 kidnapped since the U.S. invaded. And the United Nations mission, they're still there in Iraq, said nearly 900 civilians were killed across Iraq just in September. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. You're welcome, Iraqis. You know that in the financial world, there's often a strategy when banks have trouble to take their troubled assets, as they're called. They were called toxic assets, but that sounded too nasty. Their troubled assets and split them off and leave the remaining good assets in what's called a good bank, and then put the troubled assets in a so-called bad bank. This, of course, raises the question, is there in the current environment such a thing as a good bank? So now, ladies and gentlemen, news of bad banks.
Bad bank.
The watchdog here in the United Kingdom, where I'm broadcasting from, the Financial Conduct Authority released an update this week into its inquiry into interest rate hedging products and whether leading banks mis-sold excessively complex products to small British businesses. It's finding banks have been too slow in reviewing these deals with customers. The industry, of course, has been racked by myriad scandals since the original crisis, from the LIBOR fixing to mis-sold so-called payment protection insurance. This resulted in huge fines to some of the banks. We expect to see the pace at which cases are resolved and redress paid quicken over the coming months, said the head of the Financial Conduct Authority. Many small business owners have been waiting too long to find out if they were mis-sold. Mis-sold. That's a nice word for fraud, isn't it? The authority says it expects real progress in the coming weeks, and it told the banks it expects customers who have joined the review to have received compensation owed by the end of the year. And more bad bank news. Joseph Smith, the National Mortgage Settlement Oversight Monitor, this is the guy who was supposed to oversee the performance of banks that settled with the federal and state governments over mortgage fraud and other mis-selling practices a couple years ago. There's a monitor to see that the banks are living up to their agreement in the settlement. His name is Joseph Smith. He reported on Wednesday that the servicers are violating the spirit, if not the specific terms of the settlement. These servicers are the banks which actually receive mortgage payments. They may not be the originators of the mortgage or even the holders of the note, but they're in the business of collecting. They've been denying a prompt decision on loan modifications for borrowers, as well as the ban on dual tracking, meaning offering a modification while foreclosing at the same time. That's a nice thing. These four new metrics, says Smith, address a number of persistent issues involving the loan modification process, including billing statement accuracy. That's right. They haven't got that down yet. Bad banks, ladies and gentlemen. Is there really any other kind? Hello. Welcome to, well, let's let the Beatles sing it.
We hope you will enjoy the show.
From London, England, home of the imperialism that has yielded us most of the trouble spots in the world today, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, first of all, you remember Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican of Texas. He's the widely believed to be one of the masterminds of the current Republican congressional strategy to try to defund Obamacare by shutting down the federal government. He gave a 21-hour monologue, faux filibuster in the Senate on the subject, and later described it as akin to the Bataan Death March in its length and difficulty, which aroused the ire of some veterans of the Bataan Death March. And so here's Senator Ted Cruz talking to a couple of them.
Well, I mean, let me say to each of you, I apologize for causing offense. I should not have said what I did. I was not attempting to compare my filibuster to that suffering. At the end of what had been nearly 22 hours, and I was thanking the floor staff. You know, there are a number of staff on the Senate floor who had to be there the whole night, and it was in the context of thanking them that I thank them for enduring, and that's when I use the analogy. I was trying to say that they had endured a long period of suffering, not of their choosing, but I understand that that comment caused offense, and I apologize. That was not my intention to do so, and in fact, my intention was to thank them for their service, is what I was trying to say.
You could see how a filibuster comes easily to him. The billionaire who created Beanie Babies pleaded guilty this week to tax evasion charges and apologized. "I apologize for my conduct," said H. Ty Warner, talking to a federal judge, as he removed his designer tortoiseshell glasses and wiped away tears. "This is a terrible way to meet, Your Honor," he said. "I have so much to be thankful for. There's no excuse for my actions." He's accused of failing to report income he earned in an offshore bank account. Prosecutors say he maintained a secret account balancing about $93 million. Imagine that. Many members of an audience of mostly Ole Miss students, including an estimated 20 Ole Miss football players — Ole Miss is the University of Mississippi, of course — openly disrespected and disrupted the theater department's production of the Laramie Project this week at the Meek Auditorium. That's right. The meek shall inherit the jerks. Cast members of the play, which is about an openly gay male who was murdered in Laramie County, Wyoming, said members of the audience became so disruptive at times they struggled to complete the play. Know the feeling, babe. The football players attended the play because they're enrolled in a freshman-level theater course that requires them to attend a specific number of plays throughout the semester. The football players were certainly not the only audience members that were being offensive, said the director of the theater, but they were definitely the ones who seemed to initiate others in the audience to say things, too. The football players were asked by the athletics department to apologize to the cast, said the director of the theater department. However, she added, "I'm not sure the players truly understood what they're apologizing for." The football players' apology, which was given by one undisclosed player on behalf of the entire group, caused two cast members to cry. Dateline Houston, Texas. It's been a terrifying night for a Northwest Houston family after police burst through their front door. It happened at a home where a family was living. That's what makes it a home. Police apologized to the family several times. They say they received a call about a shooting but were given the wrong address. Right away, it's "get down on the ground, get on the ground, show me your hands," said Jessica Rodriguez. She and her husband, Jose Acosta, were fast asleep when they heard the banging at the door. Houston police kicked down the door, ordered everyone inside to the ground. Two young children were in their room, as Acosta says. Police handcuffed him and led him outside. "Then I hear them say, 'You guys have the wrong apartment. It's over here.'" Police had received a frantic call about a shooting, but they got the wrong address. The actual incident was happening next door. The apartment has apologized, saying officers were given the wrong address and were told it was a life or death situation. Police even asked apartment managers to fix the door, saying they could file a claim with the city to pay for the damage. The family says that an apology is enough. Their two children are still in shock. Compare with this similar story from Wales here in Great Britain. Police have apologized to a 75-year-old woman after they smashed their way into her home by mistake. Shirley Williams was unpacking after recently moving in when she heard a bang and shots have opened the door. Officers tried to smash their way in. North Wales police say they will repair any damage. Williams' husband is in hospital. Her son was at work. She was accosted by three police officers. "My heart was pumping away, and then I started to shake. I shook for 3 days, continual shaking," said Williams, who suffers from angina and also has a pacemaker. Police in plain clothes shouted at his colleagues to stop. They'd got the wrong address. She said she was left in tears as the shock of what happened set in. She believes the police may have been looking for a previous tenant, but were surprised by the mistake, she was surprised by the mistake, as the bungalow had been empty for at least 6 weeks before she and her family moved in. But the police stayed with her for an hour and a half after the incident. Two officers later visited and gave her an orchid as an apology for what happened. Very un-Houstonian, wouldn't you say? Dateline Santa Fe, New Mexico. TV chef Anthony Bourdain has apologized for saying a popular New Mexico store used canned chili for its Frito pies. Bourdain repeatedly insulted the, quote, world-famous, unquote, Frito-Pies at a store in downtown Santa Fe during a CNN special, aired this week. It feels like you're holding warm crap in a bag, Bourdain said on the program. That'll help CNN's ratings, credibility. What would you say? The Anti-Defamation League has accepted an apology from the retailer Hobby Lobby for an employee's alleged comment that the store doesn't, quote, cater to you people. This is after a blogger reported the chain neglected to stock Hanukkah items alongside its broad range of Christmas items. In a statement published this week on the Anti-Defamation League's website, Hobby Lobby president Steve Green apologized for the alleged remark and indicated his company has, quote, deep respect for the Jewish faith. He says, for comments that, quote, may have offended anyone, especially our Jewish customers and friends. And he adds the Hobby Lobby will carry Jewish-themed items in New York and New Jersey to, quote, test the market. Just in time for Hanukkah, don't you know? Konami, I guess is a gaming company, has issued an apology to owners of the Xbox 360 version of Pro Evolution Soccer 2014 for errors related to the game's online features. That's right, it's not just Obamacare exchanges. Some users report being unable to download a required data pack to activate online multiplayer mode, and instead have been greeted with an error message claiming the download file is broken. Konami says they're in discussions with Microsoft trying to understand what might be causing this. I wonder if Microsoft is helping Obamacare. Officials at an Orange County, California high school have apologized to a 16-year-old student who was forced to take off an NRA shirt or face disciplinary action. Staff at Canyon High School in Anaheim, feel off a goofy while you're there. They changed course Thursday after demanding that Haley Bullwinkle, student named Haley Bullwinkle, ladies and gentlemen, put on a different shirt after she recently wore the NRA shirt to school. It had an American flag and a silhouette of a hunter with a rifle. The school's dress code prohibits clothing that promotes or depicts violence, criminal activity, or anything that is degrading to ethnic values. She felt her First Amendment rights were being violated. School officials determined the shirt's images didn't promote violence after a review. A St. Louis sports radio program aired a lengthy apology for this week for a high-profile incident in August when former St. Louis Cardinals star Jack Clark accused former Cardinals slugger Albert Pujol of using steroids. The owner of the Inside St. Louis Enterprises sports site, Tim McKernan, said, "We regret these statements were made. To the extent that our transmission and broadcast of these statements was perceived by anyone as indicating support for or validation of those allegations, we emphasize that we had no advance knowledge of the allegations. We did not make them. We know of no proof or evidence to substantiate them. We disavow and retract them. We sincerely apologize to Albert Pujols and his wife and family for any damage the situation may have caused them." That sounds like a lawyer writing those. The dispute began in early August when Clark was in the first week of a new afternoon talk show, and he twice pointed the steroids finger at Pujols. This is according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That must be one fat finger. A former BBC presenter accused of sexually assaulting a number of boys over a period spanning almost two decades issued an apology over comments he made to the judge and prosecutor in the case. Michael Souter apologized for comments he had made regarding the judge. He's wrong to say the learned judge has any prior knowledge of witnesses or any statements or material relating to them. And he went on to say such comments, the lawyer said any such comments made by his client, which implied anything to the contrary, were formally withdrawn by him. Said Souter himself, "I would just like to say during the course of proceedings, they did get somewhat heated. I called into question the professional integrity of the judge. I apologize unreservedly for that and ask his forgiveness for that, and I apologize to the court." Jennifer J-Wow Farley. Fans of Jersey Shore might know who she is. She's apologized for a comment about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie that was caught on tape by TMZ. A TMZ reporter asked J-Wow and Snooki, also of Jersey Shore, what they thought of Governor Christie calling himself a fighter during an interview on CBS. "He's retarded," replied J-Wow. "He's a disgrace to New Jersey, just like we were." On her Twitter feed, she apologized for her choice of words. But I do not apologize for how I feel about him. A senior official of Poland's Catholic Church apologized this week to the victims of pedophile priests. Prosecutors said they've opened a probe into allegations that two Polish priests, including a Vatican envoy, sexually abused boys in the Dominican Republic, the most painful place to be abused. The secretary of the episcopate, Bishop Wojciech Polak, I'm reading it, told a news conference the church is seeking to make amends, including to Dominican victims. The victims have been profoundly wronged, Polak said. It is a very painful situation, and we sympathize with the victims because their trust has been violated. Sorry is the least that can be said, he added. No kidding, Sherlock. Dateline Santa Fe, New Mexico once again. State Human Services Department Secretary Sidoni Squire apologized to lawmakers this week for a recent email seeming to deny the existence of hunger in New Mexico. I do agree there are hungry children in New Mexico, Squire told members of the Finance Committee during a hearing. She said her email was poorly worded. There have been a slew of apologies. There has been a slew of apologies following the Daily Mail newspaper in London alleging that the late father of the leader of the Labour Party, David Miliband, his father was Ralph Miliband, a socialist intellectual, following allegations that made by the paper that Ralph Miliband, quote, hated Britain. Lord Rothermere, the chairman of the Daily Mail, has apologized to Miliband after a reporter turned up uninvited at a family memorial service. He insisted the incident did not reflect the culture and practices of his newspapers. Editor of the Sunday Mail on Sunday also apologized to Miliband. Dateline Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett compared the marriage of same-sex couples to the marriage of a brother and sister during his appearance on a morning TV news show, and then later issued an if-pology. My words were not intended to offend anyone, he said. If they did, I apologize. What about if they didn't? How about that? And from Harry Reid, Democratic leader of the Senate, quote, some recent stories have suggested the speaker is keeping government shut because I hurt his feelings, said Reid, referring to House Speaker John Boehner. If that's true, I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings. So the if apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
We're still in Wisconsin, as far as I know. Today was Green Bay and tomorrow Chicago. Wish I was lying, but there isn't much to report. My phone is dying, so I've got to keep it short. I just wanted to say, hey, I've been writing you a road song. It's a cliche, but hey, that doesn't make it so wrong. And in between the stops at the Cracker Barrel and 40 movies with Will Ferrell, I need some way to occupy my time. So I'm writing you a road song, I sure hope you don't mind. You a light blue t-shirt last night from some band I couldn't stand, but their logo's alright. Some kid threw a bottle on stage, he had an arm like a pro. I know it's getting late, I guess I should let you go. Did I happen to say, hey, I've been writing you a road song, don't run away, cause hey, I promise it won't be too long. I know it's not what you call necessary, and I know that song that you can call your own.
This is Le Show. We caught you up on Iraq. So now news of AFPAC. And the big news there is this is the time when people are applying or registering or signing up to run for president in the presidential election, which will be held in Afghanistan next year. And guess who's running for president in Afghanistan? A former Islamist warlord who reputedly invited Osama bin Laden to live in Afghanistan. That's right. Abdul Rasul Sayaf announced his candidacy this week by driving through the capital in a motorcade made up of heavily armed former Mujahideen fighters. This is according to the Telegraph in London. Kabul has long been abuzz with reports that Sayaf was putting together a ticket of former warlords and resistance fighters for the elections. He fought against the Soviet occupation and then ran training camps during the 80s and 90s. In one of those camps, he first met bin Laden, and he's later believed to have invited bin Laden to Afghanistan when he was expelled from Sudan. He was also named in the 9/11 Commission report as the mentor of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks. Such is his fearsome reputation that Abu Sayyaf, a terrorist group in the Philippines, takes its name from him. Since the Afghan war, he has quietly stayed away from public attention, working to build close ties with Hamid Karzai, the current president. His conservative views, particularly on women, will cause concern among human rights campaigners and Western diplomats. But wait, that's not all. Who else is running for president? The former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. He was also U.S. ambassador to Iraq. He says Afghanistan will need serious cooperation from the Western nations, specifically the United States, in the future. And Mr. Khalilzad will be one of the reliable individuals for Afghanistan beyond 2014. And so he will nominate himself in the upcoming presidential election. The source close to an Afghan newspaper said Khalilzad is currently negotiating with various political parties in Afghanistan. He's also met with a number of former Mujahideen leaders and has indirectly negotiated his nomination for the upcoming election. He's got an office informally operating in Kabul where, quote, thousands are visiting his office on a daily basis, unquote. I hope they've got some sofas. But lest you think he's kidding around, the owner of one of the major television stations in Afghanistan is said to be one of the individuals who's assisting Khalilzad with his presidential election campaign. News of AFPAC, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
The phenomenon of the word so being used to begin an answer to a question, even though it's drawing no conclusion at all, continues apace. This week's examples from a discussion of the phenomenon of workers, low-wage workers in retail beginning to organize.
Tell us, for those who haven't been paying attention, what's been going on over the last six or so months among workers at low-paid retail and fast food outlets across America?
So we're actually about a month and a half away from the first anniversary of the fast food strikes.
What has happened either to these workers or to the larger society that would explain the timing of this?
So there's a few answers to that, right?
So let's start with what you think is the strength, the momentum, and the potential of this movement of low-paid workers.
So the first thing that was strong about it is that they came out with strikes.
Tell us a little bit about what the reaction was before we look at the other side.
So the Walmart campaign is something slightly different. As I mentioned, it's backed by the UFCW.
What are the things that have to be dealt with if the potential is going to be realized.
Yeah. So I talked about the labor community partnerships that are at the core of where the fast food campaign has come from.
Is any of that floating around the air among the workers that are beginning to move that you encounter?
So I have not heard any of this talk, certainly from workers right now at McDonald's or whatever.
Is there a relationship? How do you see all of this happening from your vantage point of in the trenches working with the fight at the low-income situation?
So, I mean, SEIU is not a member of the AFL-CIO.
That was a so I mean. That's a new one. But ladies and gentlemen, lest you think that I'm riding the crest of a wave here, a listener supplies this from the NPR web. You've heard of NPR, right? The NPR website. A curious and self-proclaimed faithful listener wrote to the Curious Listener column on the NPR website to say, as I listen to any of the wonderful shows you offer, the highly educated interviewees start their responses with the word so. I just wonder why this is happening. Thank you very much for your time. Most sincerely, faithful listener, M. Hast. The reply from Justin at NPR Audience and Community Relations. Dear M., thank you for contacting NPR. We appreciate your interest in NPR programming. We cannot speak on behalf of our guests regarding their individual speech patterns. However, we can speculate that the word so generally functions as a better verbal pause than while an interviewee may be considering how to phrase their answer to a question. And then the author of the Curious Listener blog, Johnny Kaufman, on the NPR website, says, it may be too soon to classify it as a fad. This curious listener may have, in fact, made an observation that's in line with current trends in talking. As it turns out, what linguists call the sentence initial O is a recent phenomenon that is slightly different than the verbal pauses NPR hosts and reporters try to avoid. We can't change the way our interviewees speak, but for those listeners who are distracted by this recent linguistic phenomenon, just think of that so as a super short version of the All Things Considered theme song, letting you know the time has come to listen. Yes, NPR is always ahead of the curve, aren't they? Please give. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time to notice this week's nutty coincidence. Not one, but two major television networks. NBC and CNN announced this week that they were giving up plans that they had announced earlier this year for programs about Hillary Rodham Clinton. In one case, in CNN's case, Charles Ferguson, the award-winning documentarian, said he was stopping his project because too many sources were drying up. He blamed that on pressure from the Clintons. NBC just said, we'd rather not do this. There had been, of course, Republican criticisms about both networks, especially CNN doing a documentary which was going to be released in theaters as well as shown on CNN, as well as and Republicans said, how can you do that and then cover the news about Hillary Clinton's putative run for the 2016 race? And the Republicans had threatened to disallow both NBC and CNN from sponsoring debates in the next presidential campaign cycle. There's also other Clinton developments. Chelsea, fresh from her bout as a journalist on the aforementioned NBC, has now joined the Clinton Foundation as vice chairman. And there are stories circulating that this is part of Hillary's campaign for her campaign. More about this next here on the show.
Clinton something. The wilderness years.
So, you're coming to the thing at Four Seasons?
Damn. I'm still working on my energy bar flakes. What is it again?
Just a board meeting of the foundation to dot all the I's and cross all the T's about Chelsea coming on board the board.
Hell, I thought all that was taken care of long since. I mean, isn't that what we have people making $500,000 apiece to do?
It's in the bylaws. We have to do some things in person.
Well, I wrote the bylaws, didn't I? Damn, these things taste like wood chips.
Look, if you don't want to go, I can see if you can FaceTime into the session.
Just to remind them what I charge for my time these days and ask them if the foundation really wants to spring for an hour of that.
What?
What's that look?
I don't think we want that showing up in New York Magazine, now do we?
Oh, hey, Touch, nobody's more protective of brand Hillary than yours truly. I mean, it was my guy called up NBC and CNN and told them that we had no issue whatso-freaking-ever with their Hillary shows.
After I had my people shutting down sources for months? Well, that was counterproductive. Or as we used to say at the State Department, not entirely helpful.
Help like beauty comes in all shapes, Toots.
Well, it might help if we stick to the subject.
Okay. One of the people you had shutting down sources was the wife of the guy who was texting pictures of his Lyndon Baines all over the known universe. That was good for brand Hillary.
Nobody held Huma responsible for what Anthony was doing any more than...
What?
Oh, nothing. Just heard an echo from my past whistling down the hallway. But in any case, why was it helpful to send exactly the wrong message to the two networks that were planning hit jobs on me right in the period before I reach a decision on whether I'm running for what I've been running for the last 2 years?
Because, babe, we're jujitsuing their skepticism about me. I know that despite all the halo effect of the foundation and just the respect that making hundreds of millions earns you in this town, some folks still don't think I shoot straight.
Some folks have seen the pictures.
I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that. So anyway, by calling and saying we've got no problem with the shows, we sowed the seeds of doubt in their minds. Why had we called? Who'd said we had problems in the first place? Maybe we were trying to sucker them into going ahead with the shows in the face of all the Republican criticism so the GOP could take their revenge by doing what they wanted anyway and having fewer stupid debates, which would mean more airtime for Democratic debates where, of course, you'd shine like the whole diamond at high noon. By the time the network guys got so wound up in their second guessing, they thought it was less hassle just to hit the kill switch.
This is the cleverness I fell in love with way back when.
You fell in love with Bruce Lindsay?
Okay, well, even if you don't think it's important, I've got to show up at the foundation thing. We have to get Chelsea installed on the board before the fiscal year ends.
Listen, the foundation was doing just fine. We had every billionaire in the world lining up for invitations to the global summit like deadheads for a Phil Lesh solo gig. And Chell was doing fine, being what, a TV journalist this year, or head of a multicultural center at NYU, or whatever the hell the latest idea was for how she made a living.
Listen, Bill, we've had this conversation before. My sacrificing days are over. It's your turn now. The foundation isn't going to be run as a wholly owned subsidiary of Bill Clinton's ego anymore. It's got to be straighter than Cher's wigs and more disciplined than the Soul Train dancers. If it isn't helping me, the least that I can ask is that it doesn't hurt me. And whatever job Chell isn't good at, she's very good at the job of not hurting me. She's got her name on the foundation stationery. She's going to be vice chairman. And if we have to FaceTime you into the board meeting, that's what we're going to do. Even if your face is still stuffed with energy bar flakes.
You know, maybe somebody should tell these people that most folks still have taste buds.
So?
Okay, give me 5 minutes. I'll get my hang with the billionaire shoes on.
Just remember, Bill.
What?
Some of us haven't stopped thinking about tomorrow.
Yeah.
Youthful angst and middle-aged lust for power. Together they add up to Clinton something. The wilderness years.
hate parading my serenading as I'll probably miss a bar. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the tablet, you're the Colosseum, you're the top, you're the art museum, you're a melody from a symphony by Strauss, you're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet, you're Mickey Mouse, you're the Nile, you're the Tower of Pisa, you're the smile on the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flop. But a baby on the bottom, you're the top. You're the bop. You're like Sarah singing. You're the bop. You're like Yardbird swinging. You're the miner's gong. You're the greatest song that Eckstein ever sung. You're a Moscow view. You're oh so cool. You're Lester Young. You're the high in a downbeat tally. You're the guy who owns 10 Van Alley. You're Tatum's left hand, a Goodman swing band, a Lena Horne who won't stop. But a baby on the bottom, you're the bop.
But if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top. I wonder what he was saying there, really. Tell me. Email me if you have an idea. Ladies and gentlemen, now, news of our friend the Atom. Addy the Atom is here with us in London. You enjoy this beautiful, beautiful Sunday, Addy?
They're all the same to me.
All right, then. It wasn't a tsunami, but it had the same effect. A huge cluster of jellyfish forced one of the world's largest nuclear reactors to shut down, a phenomenon that marine biologists say could become more common. Operators of the...
You going to really pronounce that?
I'm going to try. The Oskarshamn nuclear plant in southeastern Sweden had to scramble nuclear reactor number 3 last week after tons of jellyfish clogged the pipes that bring in cool water to the plant's turbines. Seems to be the cooling part of running a nuclear plant that's trouble these days, don't you think?
I don't think. I'm an atom.
Okay. By Tuesday, the pipes had been cleaned of the jellyfish and engineers were preparing to restart the reactor, which is the largest boiling water reactor in the world. So, of course, you need water to cool boiling water. All three reactors are boiling water types, the same technology as at Japan's Fuuk plant. Jellyfish are not a new problem for nuclear power plants. Last year, the Diablo Canyon facility in California had to shut its reactor 2 after gobs of sea salp.
Sounds good.
No, it's a gelatinous jellyfish-like organism, clogged intake pipes. And in 2005, the first unit at the Swedish plant was temporarily turned off due to another sudden jellyfish influx.
They're good eating, aren't they?
They are not. Nuclear power plants need a constant flow of water to cool the reactor and turbine systems. Marine biologists say they would not be surprised if more jellyfish shutdowns occur in the future. Quote, it's true that there seems to be more and more of these extreme cases of blooming jellyfish.
Is that a swear word?
No, it's just a description. According to Lene Moller, a researcher at the Swedish Institute for the Marine Environment. But Moller adds it's very difficult to say if there are more jellyfish because there's no historical data. The species that caused the shutdown at Oskarshamn is known as the common moon jellyfish.
You mean jellyfish moon?
That's right. It's one of the species that can bloom in extreme areas that are overfished or have bad conditions, said Moller. The moon jelly likes these types of waters. They don't care if their algae blooms. They don't care if the oxygen concentration is low. The fish leave and the moon jelly can really take over the ecosystem. Mueller said the biggest problem was there's no monitoring of the jellyfish in the Baltic Sea to produce the data that scientists need to figure out how to tackle the issue.
More data, more data.
More data, indeed. A TEPCO spokesperson is explaining another problem at Fouque. Contaminated water overflowed from a storage tank at the Fouque station as heavy rains compounded their difficulties managing irradiated water at the wrecked plant. The estimated 430-liter leak...
How many ounces is that?
I have no idea. Occurred as crews transferred rainwater that had collected at the plant into a storage tank. The tank was already partially filled with water that had been used to cool nuclear fuel. Radiation levels, beta radiation levels, of 200,000 becquerels per liter were found near the leak that was confirmed this week. Beta radiation includes stridium-90, which safety rules require to be under 30 becquerels at atomic plants. These were 200,000.
That's slightly more.
That is slightly more. Heavy seasonal rainfall is adding to TEPCO's troubles in its attempt to maintain and manage contaminated water that's filling tanks at the plant at the rate of 400 metric tons a day. There are long-term issues that we need to solve and respond to firmly. That's Masayuki Ono, an official at the Fouque plant. We are very sorry that something like this happened.
Here's an apology of the week.
Yes, indeed. The Fouque monitoring station recorded 6.9 inches of rain last month and much less so far this month. The rainwater, well, it's early in the month. The rainwater being transferred when the accident occurred had collected between a contaminated water storage tank and a cement barrier around the tank built to contain possible leaks, according to TEPCO. The water may have overflowed because the 450-ton capacity tank had been built on a slope and was at a slight tilt, according to Ono.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. TEPCO said in the statement it can't rule out the possibility that some of the water flowed to the sea.
Again with the sea.
Again with the sea. And a TEPCO spokesman told a press conference in Tokyo that the leak did happen because workers miscalculated the amount of water the tank was capable of holding due to it sitting on a slope.
Those damn slopes.
They'll get you every time. When senior scientist Walter Tamosaitis warned in 2011 about functional design flaws at the nation's largest, this is the U.S.'s largest facility to treat radioactive waste in Hanford, he was assigned to work in a basement room without office furniture or a telephone. This week, Tamosaitis, an employee of URS Corporation.
Not URS.
No, URS. Was laid off from his job after 44 years from the company. With the company. The concerns that he raised 2 years ago about the design of the waste treatment plant, a $12 billion industrial complex to turn highly radioactive sludge into glass. Those concerns were validated by the federal investigators. Construction of the plant was halted. The Energy Department is trying to address a wide range of problems with the design. Only last June, newly appointed Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz met with Tamosaitis near the Hanford site, where we produce plutonium. The meeting raised Tamosaitis' hopes that the longstanding problems with safety at the project would get high-level attention. Then, 2 weeks ago, Moniz, Secretary of Energy, issued a highly unusual statement that reaffirmed the Energy Department's commitment to safety, saying, quote, "We will pursue a safety culture built on an environment of trust and mutual respect, worker engagement, and open communication, an atmosphere that promotes a questioning attitude with effective resolution of reported problems and continuous learning," unquote.
It's a nice statement.
It's a very nice statement. But on Thursday, Tamosaitis, a systems engineer with a doctoral degree who directed a staff of 100 scientists until he began expressing concerns about safety, said officials of his company,
URS,
showed up and ordered him to box up his personal belongings and then escorted him out. The company says in a statement, as a matter of policy, it would not comment on employee matters, but it reduced employment levels due to budgetary constraints.
Those damn budgets.
Those damn budgets. And you might be interested in this, Addy.
Really?
Yes. More problems at Hanford. Bechtel, which is building a $12 billion waste treatment plant, has been buying critically important parts without subjecting them to the required quality assurance regime. This according to the Energy Department's Inspector General. Gregory Friedman said a sample of 235 design documents over a three-year period showed Bechtel had failed to run more than a third of its design changes in equipment purchased from subcontractors past Bechtel's own environmental and nuclear safety group, as is required. Friedman says the shortcomings could cause delays and cost increases for the Hanford cleanup plan, which has already experienced years of delay and billions of dollars of cost overruns. And he faulted the Energy Department for failing to properly oversee Bechtel's progress.
How can they? They're not making any.
Very, very apt comment by Addie the Atom. News of our clean, cheap, safe to meet to feeder, our friend the Atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? The oceans are more acidic now than they have been for at least 300 million years due to carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels, and a mass extinction of the key species in the ocean may already be almost inevitable as a result, leading marine scientists warned this week, according to the Guardian newspaper. An international audit of the health of the oceans has found that overfishing and pollution are also contributing to the crisis in a deadly combination of destructive forces that are imperiling marine life, on which only billions of people depend for their livelihood. In its starkest warning yet of the threat to ocean health, the International Program on the State of the Ocean, the IPSO, issued some facto. Quote, the acidification is unprecedented in the Earth's known history. We are entering an unknown territory of marine ecosystem change and exposing organisms to intolerable evolutionary pressure. The next mass extinction may have already begun. Unquote. The IPSO published its findings in the State of the Oceans report, collated every 2 years from global monitoring and other research studies. Alex Rogers, professor of biology at Oxford University, says, quote, the health of the ocean is spiraling downwards far more rapidly than we had thought. We are seeing greater change happening faster, and the effects are more imminent than previously anticipated. The situation should be of the gravest concern to everyone, since everyone will be affected by changes in the ability of the ocean to support life on Earth, unquote. Coral is particularly at risk. Increased acidity dissolves the calcium carbonate skeletons that form the structure of reefs. Increasing temperatures lead to bleaching, where the corals lose the symbiotic algae they rely on. Current pledges by governments to curb carbon emissions will not go far enough or fast enough to save many of the world's reefs. Coral reefs are vital to the health of fisheries. They act as nurseries to young fish and smaller species that provide food for bigger ones. In absorbing carbon and heat from the atmosphere, the world's oceans have shielded humans from the worst effects of global warming, the marine scientists said. This has slowed the rate of climate change on land, but its profound effects on marine life are only now being understood. Jane Lubchenco, former director of NOAA and a marine biologist, says the effects are already being felt in some oyster fisheries where young larvae are failing to develop, properly in areas where the acid rates are higher, such as on the west coast of the United States. You can actually see this happening, she said. It's not something a long way into the future. It's a very big problem, unquote. But the chemical changes in the ocean go farther, said Rogers. Marine animals use chemical signals to perceive their environment and locate prey and predators. There's evidence that their ability to do so is being impaired in some species. Trevor Manuel, a South African government minister and co-chair of the Global Ocean Commission, called the report, quote, a deafening alarm bell on humanity's wider impacts on global oceans, unquote. But hey, Snooki's on TV. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 9.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. On the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available on the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Did I mention that already? Maybe. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at Sideshow Network, iTunes, and SoundCloud, among other places. I'm always discovering new ones. That podcast gets around. And it would be just like turning off Snooki and JWoww if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Tibetla Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast, the playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store. Hey, Christmas is coming again. All available for you at harryshearer.com. And, I yak 140 characters at a time at you at the Harry Shearer on Twitter, on the Twitters. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.